Hello, everyone. Dan Dillman here, bringing you a little of this, a little of that. Today's program, it begins with something that we are now becoming acquainted with very quickly, I think. It's called Life Online, the Age of Zoom. I was reading The Week magazine recently, and here it was, a brief article about Zooming. It says, we live in Zoom now. The 9-year-old video conferencing platform has become arguably the most indispensable technology in the world now that the coronavirus pandemic has locked us all inside. College students joke that they now attend Zoom University. Weddings and funerals are being held virtually. Most businesses pick Zoom because it works. Even Zoom's chief executive, Eric Yuan, said he never expected every person in the world would suddenly be working, studying, and socializing from home. This seismic cultural shift comes with some major growing pains, though. Researchers have pointed out that there are flaws in Zoom's programming code that leave people's computers exposed to breaches. And more than 15,000 personal Zoom videos have been recently left viewable on the open web, easily discovered by tools that find meeting IDs. The meeting ID flaw has led to Zoom bombing by intruders. Dennis Johnson, for example, was recently in the middle of defending his doctoral dissertation via Zoom video conferencing when someone started drawing male genitalia on the screen. The hijacker then scrawled a racial slur that everyone on the Zoom call could see. Zoom bombers have also disrupted an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting in New York, a Sunday school in Texas, online classes at the University of Southern California, and a city meeting in Kalamazoo, Michigan. Then there's Zoom's company directory. It was designed to make it easier to find a colleague. But people who subscribed to the video chat service using a non-standard email provider, not Gmail or Yahoo, found that they could see the names, email addresses, and even photos of thousands of others with the same domain, and could even video call strangers out of the blue. Well, still, Zoom security is likely sufficient for most people's general communications, as long as we make sure to set up a password. And all the efforts to find and to publicize Zoom's holes, will make Zoom more secure in the long run. Every tech company inevitably falls victim to security flaws. Credit Zoom with acting accountably. Yuan has published a long and impressive list of fixes that the company is planning. And Zoom has paused development of new features and devoted all of its engineering resources at the moment to fixing privacy and security matters. Maybe most importantly, Eric Yuan has admitted that he really messed up, showing other companies how to respond to criticism in the right way. The disappearance of The Office. Now in this post-pandemic age, we're going to see considerable change in the way that people do their work and where they do their work. As businesses start to reopen in some parts of the country, white-collar workers aren't rushing back to the office. The coronavirus pandemic has created new fans of remote work among those who don't miss the commute, who have found new heights of productivity away from meetings and office chit-chat. Their hope now is that the pandemic has shown managers that workers can be trusted to do their jobs without constant supervision. Some corporations, seeing an opportunity for cost savings, are eager to oblige workers who want to stay at home. The insurer Nationwide moved 98% of its 27,000 employees to working from home. It's worked so well that Nationwide plans to shrink from 20 physical offices pre-crisis to just 4. For those who do return to the office, the pandemic may usher in new kinds of workplace surveillance. In the Rockefeller Center complex in New York, thermal cameras will measure body temperatures as employees arrive, while advertising giant Interpublic Group is exploring dividing up its 22,000 employees into 3 separate groups based on age and other perceived health risks that workers will be required to disclose. RXR, a real estate conglomerate, is even testing a social distancing app that assigns scores like a video game, giving workers points for staying 6 feet away from the colleagues. One worry: if companies start tracking your movements in an office, they may be reluctant to stop. Employers don't really have any incentive to remove surveillance once they install it, says one critic of workplace monitoring technologies. However, companies end up monitoring workers one way or the other, and the combination of the pandemic and new technology could finally kill the open office. A decade ago, a team of research scientists tried to see how quickly a virus could spread in the modern office. They placed a harmless virus on the door to an 80-person office, an open office. And by the end of the day, every surface they tested had some trace of the virus. If people are mainly using Slack to talk anyway, what's the point of coughing on each other in the same place? Landlords and architects are already designing layouts to minimize interactions. The office real estate giant Cushman & Wakefield drew up reopening plans based on its experience in China. Besides temperature checks, masks, sanitizers, and wipes, they call for rearranging floor plans and conference rooms, and yes, for installing cubicles. You're going to see a lot of plexiglass from now on, the company says. Having that divider will make people feel safer. Everyone complains about the weather, and these scientists and inventors that I'm going to tell you about set out to change it. For example, we might look at the rainmakers. In 1946, Vincent Schaefer, who worked for General Electric, discovered that dry ice supercooled solid carbon dioxide could be used to create an artificial cloud full of tiny ice crystals. Further experimentation led to the seeding of clouds with dry ice. Silver iodide, or other chemicals that were dropped from an airplane to catalyze precipitation. Though cloud seeding has not fulfilled its promises, it is used to generate powder for ski areas and rainfall in the United Arab Emirates, the Middle East, where up to 15% of annual precipitation is actually man-made. Well, here's one that is really far out. And as I talk about it, please believe this is not a pun. It's called In the Shade. In 1989, James Early, an engineer in California, proposed going to the moon to assemble a glass parasol more than 1,200 miles across that would be launched into space to deflect solar radiation. Other experts have made similar suggestions, including an enormous orbiting mirror or a cloud of millions of umbrella-like spacecraft floating between the Earth and the Sun. That's not all. In what might be termed vineyard defense, we have this. For more than a century, farmers around the world have fired hail cannons at the sky to stave off the precipitation delicate. The trend in the 1890s, when an Austrian wine grower raised a small army to wage war on the clouds. A tall conical device was believed to disrupt the formation of hail by blasting shock waves every few seconds during a storm. While proof of their efficacy is anecdotal at best, hail cannons are still in use at vineyards from California to New Zealand. Think about that the next time you have a glass of your favorite beverage from grapes. And then there's this. Or what I call blazing away. James Espy, a 19th century school teacher known as the Storm King, made contributions to the study of cyclones, but he never secured permission to test his most audacious idea, and that is setting massive forest fires to regulate the continent's weather. The heat from weekly blazes in the Rocky and Appalachian Mountains, he would argue back in 1845, would ensure that it would rain enough and not too much, and that the health and happiness of the citizens would be much promoted. Well, that never came to pass. And then there's this about weaponizing the weather. Operation Popeye was a classified U.S. program that deployed cloud seeding during the Vietnam War. The aim was to hinder North Vietnamese troops and to suppress anti-aircraft fire. Whether the program worked or not remains in question. But after it became public in 1972, it prompted a congressional investigation and eventually a United Nations treaty forbidding military action intended to cause earthquakes, tsunamis, and changes in weather patterns. Believe it or not, and this was from the Smithsonian Magazine in April 2020. There is an article in Time Magazine, May 18th, that I think you should read. It's a provocative article, and it's entitled, "Now is the Moment to Change the World." How will the coronavirus change the world? No one knows yet, but we do know where we were before the pandemic hit. Inequality had reached historic records worldwide. Australia had burned for months on end. Autocrats were suffocating democracy in Hungary and in Venezuela. And a wave of protests had swept across six continents, from Beirut to Paris, from Hong Kong to Moscow. And then came COVID-19. The virus laid bare the world's extraordinary inequalities and injustices. Lists of so-called vital professions were published all over the world, and surprise, positions such as hedge fund manager and tax specialist for multinationals weren't on those lists. Suddenly, it was crystal clear who did the really important work in healthcare and education, in public transport, and in supermarkets. The general rule seemed to be the more vital your work, the less you're paid. The more secure your employment and the more at risk you are in the fight against the coronavirus. Well, let's be clear. These are circumstances in which history is written. In the 1930s, for example, the New Deal was conceived in the midst of the Great Depression. In the United Kingdom of the 1940s, the Beveridge Report, the prime text of the British welfare state, was published while bombs fell on London. There's an old quote. Once you hear it, it's hard to forget it. It's from Milton Friedman, one of the most influential economists of the 20th century. In 1982, he wrote, Only a crisis, actual or perceived, produces real change. When that crisis occurs, the actions that are taken depend on the ideas that are lying around. Right now, we are in the biggest crisis since the Second World War. The economic impact of COVID-19 is greater than the impact of the Great Recession of 2008, and may be even greater than that of the Great Depression of the 1930s. And if history teaches us anything, it's that extraordinary things are possible. Everything depends on the ideas that are lying around. And so you might well ask, what are those ideas? In 2011, the protester was Time's Person of the Year. And since then, ideas that used to be dismissed as unreasonable or unrealistic have moved into the mainstream. Think about how a previously obscure academic like Thomas Piketty became a famous economist around the world. Think about how an unknown Asian American businessman, Andrew Yang, galvanized millions of Americans with an idea, universal basic income, that just a couple of years ago was almost forgotten. And think about how a Swedish girl, Greta Thunberg, still only 17, kickstarted the biggest climate justice movement this world has ever seen. And in April this year, the Financial Times, the world's leading business paper, published an article from the editorial board of that paper that showed just how much the times have changed. Radical reforms, reversing the policy direction of the last four decades, will need to be put on the table, the paper said. Policies, until recently considered eccentric, such as basic income and wealth taxes, will have to be in the mix. You can hardly believe that we're reading that. But this, the Financial Times, not exactly a left-wing paper, was saying that we need to tax the rich and increase the size of the government and give free money to everyone? You could say, well, this is all very interesting, but didn't you get the memo about the socialist who was crushed in Britain's elections, Jeremy Corbyn? And didn't you hear that the revolutionary Bernie Sanders actually lost to moderate Joe Biden? Haven't Social Democrats been losing election after election in Europe? That's true. But when we zoom out, we can see that something bigger is going on. Just look at the platform on which the moderate Biden is running. His tax plan is twice as radical as Hillary Clinton's tax plan of 2016. His $1.7 trillion climate plan includes 30 times as much clean energy commitment as Clinton did in 2016, and is even more ambitious than that of Sanders 4 years ago. And yes, Jeremy Corbyn in the United Kingdom did lose the elections, but the Conservatives' eventual public service spending was closer to Labour's plans than to their own manifesto. And so this is just the introduction of that article. And You might disagree with some of the ideas in it, but you might agree with others. It is well worth reading. Again, it was Time Magazine, May 18th of this spring. And so, this last article, this last item of the day, takes us to the end. And I'm hoping that you'll tune in next time to hear a little of this and a little of that. We enjoy finding these little bits of information that are often very different from each other. But we hope that you enjoy hearing that diversity, and we'll come back and hear it again. And so for this time, your host, Dan Dillman, wishing you Godspeed, take care of yourself, and I'll speak to you very soon. Goodbye.